So I have Michael Novick on the phone from Anti-Racist Action LA and People Against Racist Terror. I guess, could you tell us what you do for anti-racist work?
We're part of the ARA network, Anti-Racist Action, which is an international direct action network of anti-racist groups, some of which use the name ARA and other chapters use other names, but we all participate together based on four principles of unity, basically opposing racism and fascism in all its forms, not relying on the state and the courts or the cops to do that work, defending other anti-racists and anti-fascists under attack, and defending reproductive rights and opposing all forms of racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and oppression of the disabled. ARALA puts out a newspaper called Turning the Tide. We've been putting it out for almost 25 years at this point. It's the Journal of Anti-Racist Action, Research and Education. We participate in exposing open white supremacist activity and also, organized neo-Nazi type groups, as well as state repression. We've been involved in the Jericho Amnesty Movement, which is a national movement to free all political prisoners in the United States, ranging from the COINTELPRO prisoners of the 60s and 70s to people like Julianna Zucker or Eric McDavid, more recently Daniel McGowan, and other cases like that. Recently, we've been involved in a coalition in Los Angeles called Grassroots KPFK, which is an effort to try to get our local Pacifica station to pay more attention to anti-racist, anti-white supremacist, anti-colonialist struggles, people of color and struggle in Southern California, and to relate its coverage to what's really going on in the communities. So through that coalition, we were recently involved in a couple of conferences trying to reach grassroots forces that are dealing with issues of racism and oppression locally here in L.A. One was a housing and hunger crisis conference that we did in April, and in May we also worked on what was called the People's Justice Conference. Excuse me for a second. And both of those, we worked with a large array of other organizations, basically trying to do alliance building and base building for anti-colonial and anti-racist politics, dealing with the concrete conditions that people are facing. So the Housing and Hunger Crisis Conference, we worked with LA CAN, which is Los Angeles Community Action Network. It's an organization mostly of homeless people fighting police sweeps in downtown Los Angeles. We worked with different groups opposing foreclosures, a lot of which have taken on a racist form here in Los Angeles, because most of the people targeted for foreclosures have been people of color who were forced into really exploitive mortgages in the first place. And what we tried to do with that conference was basically bring together people dealing with different aspects of the same problem. So we were dealing with people trying to liberate spaces and do squats, homeless people facing police sweeps, people fighting to save their homes from foreclosure, tenants' rights groups. We work also with the Black Riders Liberation Party and the Brown Riders, who are basically growing out of former gangbangers, people involved in the Crips and the Bloods, trying to develop a revolutionary consciousness and stop internecine fighting among their own people and deal with the system that creates those kind of antagonisms as a divide and conquer method. They've been involved with struggles end police repression inside public housing and also the privatization of public housing. There's a big drive in Los Angeles basically for what grew out of the 60s. There's a strategy called spatial deconcentration. The government realized that people of color concentrated in the inner city represented a big threat here in L.A. We've seen a number of rebellions over the years, 65 in Watts and 92 after the Rodney King incident, and it's a constant issue. And so one of the things that's been happening is an attempt to scatter people, to basically do a kind of ethnic cleansing of the inner city. So that's some of what we see going on with the homeless people in downtown L.A. who are predominantly and people of color, mainly black. But also we see that in the public housing being privatized, not only here in Los Angeles, but around the country under the Obama administration. And so people are being forced out into the old white flight suburbs, the collar counties, out to Pomona and Lancaster and areas very remote in L.A. County, or even further out into Riverside, San Bernardino. And given Section 8 housing vouchers to live out in those areas to basically gentrify the areas of the city closer in that they have been living in. And similarly with the People's Justice Conference, we try to bring together a lot of people dealing with different aspects of the colonialism and racism inside the criminal justice system. We have a two-day conference at L.A. Trade Tech College in downtown L.A., and at that conference, again, we brought together people dealing with political prisoners, people dealing with police terror, racial profiling and police killings. We had the L.A. Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant, the L.A. Coalition for Community Control Over the Police. We had All of Us or None, which is a national effort for civil rights for formerly incarcerated people. A women's organization here in L.A. called A New Way of Life, which basically deals with transition for women coming out of prison because women of color have been imprisoned in extremely large numbers. And so L.A. Can, again, participated. And so what we're trying to do is build up, really, on the basis of solidarity and an alliance, not just opposing white supremacists who proclaim themselves as such, but institutionalized racism, colonialism, and exploitation that goes on in society, with the sense that we all have a common struggle, and that as people of European descent, we have a role to play in resisting those institutions and in aligning ourselves and aligning ourselves with colonized people and oppressed people, people facing racism and racist oppression. And some of the type of fascist forces that the state also applies, not only, neo-Nazi groups, but the police play a certain role, the military plays a certain role as well.
How did you personally get involved in anti-racist work?
I've been playing away this for a long time. I come out of the movement of the 60s myself, and so my background is I was grew up as an Orthodox Jew in Brooklyn. My father was an immigrant from Poland in the 1930s, came here as a teenager, he did, and so most of his family was wiped out in Poland by the Nazis. My parents met on a picket line in the Lower East Side of New York. So I grew up with a certain understanding of what was going on in the world and in society that targeted, people I knew. And I went to a four-year public college in New York. At that time it was tuition-free, Brooklyn College. And I was involved in, anti-war struggles, student rights struggles, student evaluation of teachers, cops off the campus, stop military recruitment. But when we turned attention to the fact that this was a public four-year college in Brooklyn, which even then was about 40 or 50% black and Puerto Rican as an area of New York, and the population of the students was 98.5% white, that this was institutionalized racism right where we were. And unfortunately, what happened when we did that is a lot of the students who had been involved in all the other struggles against, police on the campus, for free speech and student rights, suddenly actually turned on us. It wasn't just that they didn't want to be involved in a struggle, but all the early arguments that you might have heard against affirmative action they were making at the time basically saying that if black and Puerto Rican students were admitted to that college, it would, you know, destroy the value of their diplomas. It would prevent their brothers or sisters from going to college. And it was really an object lesson to me that if you're doing any kind of organizing, you have to directly challenge and confront institutionalized and internalized racism, because otherwise all the work you do is kind of a house of cards and will collapse. So I've basically been involved in anti-racist organizing ever since, and particularly around the idea that people of European descent need to grapple with that themselves. One of the impacts of the struggles we waged at that time was that there was an opening of the college. We won, actually, a struggle for open admissions to Brooklyn College and to the City University of New York, and the result of it was that instead of having 10,000 students, they admitted 15 to 17,000 students. It wasn't that anybody lost the chance to go to college. It was just that, you know, 50 or 60% more people could go to college based on that struggle. And the people who were able to get into the college were not only black and Puerto Rican students, but actually other working class white kids, you know, Irish and Italian. Working class kids were able to enter college for the first time as well. So, you know, I think that people have a stake in waging this struggle. It's not like white guilt or something. It's a sense of responsibility and a sense of capacity and a sense of trying to make a different world. You have to confront racism internally. You know, I do a lot of anti-Nazi work, but in doing it, one of the things I always remind people is that if you're pointing the finger, you know, at the Nazis, three fingers are pointing back at yourself, in the sense of anybody doing anti-racist work has to be self-critical and look at institutionalized racism, white privilege, and other factors that maintain the system. It's not just a question of, you know, a few Nazis, because if that were the problem, it would have been settled long ago. It's a institutionalized system. It's a historically rooted system of privilege, of empire, of colonialism. And so I basically have always sought to try to build alliances, to enter coalitions, and to, you know, take up that struggle in a way that says, everybody has a stake in the struggle who is oppressed or exploited in any way, but that dealing with racism is essential to finding the strength and finding the solidarity to do something effective about it.
I was wondering if you could talk more about the differences between how people are affected by racism overtly institutionalized and what you're saying internal as well.
Well, you know, to go back to the People's Justice Conference, one of the factors you talked about is that you know, there's a historical dynamic that's operating here. And so, you know, I would do a lot of work, as I said, around political prisoners. And, you know, there are political prisoners from all the nationalities. There are people of European descent who were involved in struggles going back to the 60s, and people currently who have been involved in, you know, earth liberation, animal liberation, and other related struggles who get locked up. At the same time, the fundamental force that was operating was a force of racism in society, and so a lot of the key political prisoners were people who were involved in the Black Liberation Movement, particularly the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the American Indian Movement, the Brown Berets, the Young Lords, and different forces in the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. And as the government, you know, moved against those forces because they represented actually a threat to transform the society, it had an impact beyond the ranks of just those particular organizations onto whole sectors of society. So when I was coming up, there was a very mass consciousness among a lot of white young people that, you know, there was something wrong with the society and it needed to be changed in a fundamental way. And there was a break in people's identification with the empire and unification with those things. And, you know, in a large-scale way, people began to understand that, you know, solidarity and anti-racist struggle was needed. As that was extinguished by state repression and by fear and internal weaknesses of elitism, racism, and sexism inside people, then what you saw was actually the state could move very, very widely to massify incarceration. And that was based on various appeals by, you know, mainstream political figures, you know, ranging from Richard Nixon, who just proclaimed the, you know, 40th anniversary of his proclamation of the war on drugs, which grew out of a very conscious strategy on his part to find a way to deal with what he called the blacks without naming them as such. But the phenomenon is not limited to black people by any means. You know, as I say, when I was a youngster, there were maybe 200,000 people in prison in the whole United States, so they started locking up, you know, people like Geronimo DiGiorgio, who passed away recently, former Black Panther. And today, because they did succeed in breaking that resistance, those struggles, and those freedom fighters were locked away and isolated, there's now over 2,200,000 people in prison. And that's not just a black issue. In other words, there are probably more white people in prison today than there were people in prison entirely, you know, 40 years ago. And because people have internalized the idea that it is only racism, that somehow racism only affects the people of color, there's no solidarity with the people who are locked up. And so it's left to the white supremacists to organize inside the prisons. They claim, you know, that they're for their white comrades, and creating things like the Nazi lowriders and the, you know, the Aryan Brotherhood. But in fact, what you're seeing recently is that, and I think that some of this has been an impact of work that ARA is doing, and we distribute, I would say, 1,300 to 1,500 copies of Turning the Tide into the prisons every issue. And we're getting more and more responses from white prisoners who are saying, you know, you kind of opened my eyes. I started getting your papers just to cost you money. I was a Nazi. And now I see that, you know, I have some common ground to struggle against capitalism, against imperialism, against this system. So right now in California, there's about to be launched a hunger strike by prisoners in the special housing unit at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is up near the Oregon border. And they specifically have come forward to say that it's, you know, black and new African prisoners, it's white prisoners, it's Mexican, you know, norteños and sureños, as they describe themselves, you know, and they have united across racial lines to say that they have common demands and a common struggle, and they, you know, if they got locked up because of alleged gang affiliation with a white gang or a black gang or the Black Guerrilla family, that, you know, that they're suffering and facing exploitation by a system that's designed to keep them at each other's throats and use that racism to actually deny that all of them their rights. And I think that that's something that we can really learn. We saw the same thing recently in Georgia. There was a massive prisoner strike, which got very little attention outside. You know, people talk a lot about Wisconsin and that struggle, but Wisconsin was honestly mostly a white labor struggle. In Georgia, there were white prisoners, black prisoners, you know, Mexicano, indigenous prisoners uniting in a you know, sit-down strike in which they refused to leave their cells. And I think that the inability of you know, so-called leftists, white left, to identify with that movement of the prisoners reflects the operation of privilege and the operation of identification with the empire within the left. So I think that, you know, dealing with those struggles and looking at who's really struggling against this system and, you know, colonized people around the world who are resisting in many different ways, a lot more successfully than people in the United States are, honestly, I think should give us some idea of how to approach these questions in a different way, that the most oppressed and the people who struggle against colonialism and capitalism is what's going to strike the hardest blows against this system, you know, can give us some idea of what strategies will be the most effective to really change the world.
I was wondering if you could talk more about colonialism and how that relates to white identity.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we've tried to put forward in Turning the Tide is that it's not just a racial question by any means. It is a question of colonialism, nations and ethnicities, and the history of this country in particular is a history based on settler colonialism. And in order to become a settler, just as much as, you know, other people have had their identities obliterated. So-called white people have had identities obliterated. Maybe I'm a little bit more aware of this because my family, you know, was very recent immigrants. My father came here himself. But the bulk of so-called white society, the people were forced to really abandon their own languages, abandon their own cultures, to be blended in, homogenized into, you know, kind of Americanism and a sense of whiteness based on stolen native land, based on accepting, you know, what's sometimes called the wages of whiteness, to have a sense of superiority over, you know, African chattel slaves and unwaged labor. And, you know, here in the Southwest, I know you guys are in the Northwest, but there's quite a migration, you know, I know up through Washington State of, you know, indigenous and many kind of people. And the history of that is very, very clear. When when the United States moved west under the doctrine of manifest destiny, the idea that, you know, Aryan people, essentially so-called white people, had a destiny to rule the entire continent, they reinstated slavery. When Mexico became independent, and where I live was once part of Mexico, which was, I mean, that's a colonial creation itself, but the people there are indigenous people. They were captured and enslaved in some ways by the Spanish Empire, and then Spain also imported to what is now Mexico African people, as well as was done to, you know, Cuba and the other Caribbean islands. But when Mexico became independent in the early 1800s, they basically abolished slavery. And so, you know, so a lot of us are familiar with the story of Davy Crockett and the Alamo, and we don't quite get what actually happened there. Sam Bowie and Sam Houston and Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett were white settlers who wanted to expand slavery into territory where it had already been abolished. They were trying to move into Texas from Louisiana, from Alabama, from Tennessee, and bring the slaves with them. Mexico said, well, you're quite welcome to emigrate, only two requirements or two obligations. You can't have slaves here, and you have to be you know, loyal to our government. You have to, you know, change your citizenship. So they came, and then they immediately proceeded to foment the so-called Texas independence in order to have the freedom to exploit that land with slave labor. And so by carving Texas out of Mexico, they then created the pretext for the so-called Mexican-American War, which was a very similar war, actually, to the Iraq War. It was a fabrication of presidential power. The president at the time, James Polk, moved troops across what the Mexicans considered the international border between Mexico and Texas, and then used that as a pretext to say that, you know, American forces were attacked on American soil, and got Congress to go along with it. And so the United States did it intentionally, understanding that the purpose of that was actually to seize California. And so the United States waged that war, took, you know, what is now the U.S. Southwest, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and California. And that's really the proximate cause of the U.S. Civil War. When you read U.S. history books, you talk about Abraham Lincoln was opposed to the expansion of slavery. Well, where are they going to expand slavery to? They're going to expand slavery, you know, if you follow the Mason-Dixon line west, it's into all that territory that they stole from Mexico. And so, you know, that became the dividing line between the northern capitalists and the southern slaveocracy capitalists, to say, you know, it was Colorado, was the gold, the copper in Colorado, and the gold and silver in California, so I'm going to be mined by slave labor or free labor. You know, in the Dred Scott decision, I don't know if people are familiar with that, but it was the U.S. Supreme Court ruling which said that basically a black person has no rights that a white person has to recognize, and it was specifically about the idea that if you left slave territory and went to a free state, you were no longer a slave. That was overturned by that decision, which said that the states' rights be damned, that the federal government was going to enforce the slave owners' rights to recapture any slave who escaped into, you know, non-slave state. And so people in California were subjected, the former slaves who had lived here for 10 or more years were suddenly being captured and brought back to slave plantations in the southeast. And so that's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, I wasn't responsible for slavery, and, you know, people were just prisoners of their times, but that's not the case. There was a very clear, consistent politics that said that they wanted to expand the slave system, even though, you know, globally it was being repudiated. And we live with the consequences of that to this day, and we live the same thing with the history of the Mexicano people. There were treaties adopted with the indigenous people, with the Mexicano people, all of which have been violated. And so colonialism is not something from the dead past. It's something which is a reality at this moment in this country. You can look at Hawaii, Alaska, North Dakota, or, you know, anywhere you go, you will see that there are indigenous people whose land rights and sovereignty, I know that's been a struggle in Washington State, it's a struggle in Minnesota, and everywhere else, that people's rights to live, you know, as they lived before European settlement are under attack. And I think that we all have a responsibility to try to reshape this world on a different basis. So, you know, a lot of left groups, I think, have this idea that somehow, you know, there's going to be a change at the top, and it'll be like some kind of red government in Washington, D.C. I've seen, like, communist groups that have these maps, you know, with, like, the 50 states, you know, except they're all dyed red. And I think that a much more decentralizing, decolonizing approach is necessary. There's not going to be a single governmental entity covering all of this land. It's going to be people in different areas, you know, recognizing the sovereignty of indigenous people and trying to live in peace with them, trying to find ways to live in harmony, you know, with the survival of the planet. That means decolonization. It means, you know, uprooting these kind of racial structures. You know, I did a lot of work with the Puerto Rican independence struggle, and when I first actually got politicized in college, I was working with some Puerto Ricans, and one of them said to me, well, you know, they actually tried to teach me that George Washington is the father of my country, Puerto Rico. And I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, actually, they were teaching me the same thing, and my father came here from Poland, you know, 25 years ago, you know, what's my connection to George Washington? And I think more of us need to understand that dynamic, that we've been fed a false history, we've been fed an identification with our own oppressor. And until we start to break that identification and recognize, you know, common humanity with colonized people and oppressed people, we're not able to really wholeheartedly struggle for our own liberation and for, you know, a better world.
What are some concrete ways that people could go about decolonizing themselves in their mental outlook?
Well, I think, you know, study, building relationships with organizations and individuals that are engaged in that common struggle. I think that, you know, inside Anti-Racist Action, you know, I'm one voice and there are a lot of different aspects, and I think people are picking up on this idea. So I think that, you know, some of the things that the Black Panther Party put forth at one point, they talked about what sometimes became known as the Rainbow Coalition. The terminology they used was revolutionary intercommunalism. They said that different communities of struggle had to be created and build active solidarity through resistance and fighting, you know, alongside one another. And I think that is the fundamental way that people begin to change this relationship. The idea of it's not just about an identity, but it's who do you identify with and what do you identify as. And if you identify with other people in struggle, and you identify as someone who's struggling for a different world, then I think that begins to provide the basis, that, you know, in terms of a social practice that's about liberation. You know, I think a lot of people want to say, oh, we're all workers, and that's all it is, but that denies, you know, this whole history of nationalism and chauvinism that has to be uprooted.
I've noticed in some organizing that I've been involved in how people's differences can be used to divide them from one another, and I'm wondering how to overcome that, because it seems initially building coalitions could be kind of a delicate thing.
As I say, I think that self-critical approach to a lot of these questions is really vital. And I think, I've struggled with people for a while down here in L.A. that it's better to talk about alliance building than coalition building, because coalition building, often you see people go out and try to recruit, somebody to their coalition. And I think alliance building is more about recognizing, commonalities, for example, what's going on now inside the prisons, I think, is a kind of alliance building. And then also I think it's about not trying to dictate to people, respecting self-determination of different oppressed and colonized people, but to define their own struggles and their own timetables. So I think that that approach is more helpful. I think also in terms of trying to understand strategically what's important, I think that the question of prisons, the question of police terror, the question of opposing colonial and imperial wars, and relating different struggles to those things are really critical. In the same way that people, I think this is sometimes people don't understand the nature of this beast. It is an empire, and it's kind of a fractal system. I'm not trying to dictate to people what they have to struggle about. In other words, at any fractals are like at any level of magnification, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or a tapestry. So if you're struggling about the environment, I think you have to take into mind, questions of environmental justice and also, questions of indigenous rights. If you're struggling about, labor issues and the hollowing out of democracy and, for example, I was a teacher here in L.A. for many years and a member of the teachers' union. And the teachers came out in force a month or so ago in this kind of, post-Wisconsin thing, along with the Teamsters. But even though the teachers' union here has taken positions, in favor of a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal previously and, has come out against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they didn't say word one about that at the big labor rally. And I think that's a critical mistake and reflects, as I say, identification with the oppressor, really, and identification with privilege. And so, if you're going to struggle about labor issues, you have to, or housing issues, or, the destruction of public education, or the privatization of schools, you have to situate that in relation to the militarization of the schools and the militarization and privatization of the borders. And, begin to have a total politics. And then, it becomes clear that halfway measures and, just reforms or trying to feather your own nest are not going to make it. And that you have to have a more oppositional politics, and that will put you in connection with people who, have that understanding going in because of the nature of racism and colonialism in this society.
Well, thank you, Michael. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I just like to let people know that we put out Turning the Tide. You can check it out online at www.antiracist.org, antiracist.org. And if anybody would like to get in touch with us, it's antiracistaction_LA@yahoo.com, or our voicemail is 310-495-0299. We're happy to talk with people if you'd like to get a free copy of the paper. The PDFs of the previous issues are always posted at that website, and then we'll be happy to send you a print copy if you want to drop us a line with your mailing address. And we'd love to get response and feedback and, maintain a dialogue.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it. And you're welcome.
And that was Michael Novick of Anti-Racist Action LA and People Against Racist Terror.